hear the boy and his friends laughing, as loud as if it were happening in his own head. Then he felt Josie's hand slide into his.
"I've got peanut butter," she whispered. "We can share."
Alex sat in the conference room at the jail, across from her newest client, Linus Froome. This morning, at 4 a.m., he'd dressed in black, pulled a ski mask over his head, and robbed an Irving gas station convenience store at gunpoint. When the police were called in after Linus ran off, they found a cell phone on the ground. It rang while the detective was sitting at his desk.
"Dude," the caller said, "this is my cell phone. Do you have it?"
The detective said yes and asked where he'd lost it.
"At the Irving station, man. I was there like a half hour ago."
The detective suggested that they meet at the corner of Route 10 and Route 25A. He'd bring the cell phone. Needless to say, Linus Froome showed up and was arrested for robbery. Alex looked at her client across the scarred table. Her daughter was at this moment having juice and cookies, or story time, or advanced crayoning, or whatever else the first day of kindergarten consisted of, and she was stuck in a conference room at the county jail with a criminal too stupid to even be good at his craft.
"It says here," Alex said, perusing the police report, "that there was some contention when Detective Chisholm read you your rights."
Linus lifted his gaze. He was a kid, only 19, with acne and a unibrow.
"He thought I was dumb as shit."
"He said this to you?"
"He asked me if I could read."
All cops did. They were supposed to have the perp follow along with the Miranda rights. "And your response, apparently, was, 'Hello, fucko, do I look like a moron?'" Linus shrugged.
"What was I supposed to say?"
Alex pinched the bridge of her nose. Her days in the public defender's office were an exhausting blur of moments like this, a great amount of energy and time expended on behalf of someone who, a week, a month, a year later, would wind up sitting across from her again. And yet, what else was she qualified to do? This was the world she had chosen to inhabit. Her beeper went off. Glancing at the number, she silenced it.
"Linus, I think we're going to have to plead this one out."
She left Linus in the hands of a detention officer and ducked into the office of a secretary at the jail in order to borrow her phone.
"Thank God,"
Alex said when the person picked up on the other end. "You saved me from jumping out a second-story window at the jail."
"You forgot. There are bars,"
Whit Hobart said, laughing.
"I used to think maybe they'd been installed not to keep the prisoners in, but to prevent their public defenders from running away when they realize how bad their cases are."
Whit had been Alex's boss when she had joined the NH Public Defender's Office, but he had retired 9 months ago. A legend in his own right, Whit had become the father she'd never had, one who, unlike her own, had praise for her instead of criticism. She wished Whit were here now, instead of in some golf community on the seacoast. He'd take her out to lunch and tell her stories that made her realize every public defender had clients and cases like Linus. And then he'd somehow leave her with the bill and a renewed drive to get up and fight all over again.
"What are you doing up?" Alex said. "Early tea time?"
"Nah. Damn gardener woke me with the leaf blower. What am I missing?"
"Nothing, really, except the office isn't the same without you. There's a certain energy missing."
"Energy? You're not becoming some new-age crystal-reading hack, are you, Al?"
Alex grinned.
"No."
"Good, because that's why I'm calling. I've got a job for you."
"I already have a job. In fact, I have enough work for two jobs." Three district courts in the area are posting a vacancy in the Bar News. You really ought to put your name in, Alex.
To be a judge? She started to laugh. Whit, what are you smoking these days?
You'd be good at it, Alex. You're a fine decision maker. You're even-tempered. You don't let your emotions get in the way of your work. You have the defense perspective, so you understand the litigants. And you've always been an excellent trial attorney.
He hesitated.
Plus, it's not too often that New Hampshire has a Democratic female governor picking a judge.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, Alex said, but I am so not the right person for that job.
She knew, too, because her father had been a Superior Court justice. Alex could remember swinging around in his swivel chair, counting paper clips, running her thumbnail along the green felt surface of his spotless blotter to make a hatch-marked grid. She'd pick up the phone and talk to the dial tone. She'd pretend. And then, inevitably, her father would come in and berate her for disturbing a pencil or a file or, God forbid, himself. On her belt, her beeper began to vibrate again.
Listen, I have to get to court. Maybe we can do lunch next week.
Judges' hours are regular, Whit added. What time does Josie get home from school?
Whit.
Think about it, he said, and then he hung up.
Peter, his mother sighed. How could you possibly lose it again?
She skirted around his father, who was pouring himself a cup of coffee, and fished through the dark bowels of the pantry for a brown paper lunch sack. Peter hated those sacks. The banana never could quite fit in, and the sandwich always got crushed. But what else was he supposed to do?
What did he lose? His father asked. His lunchbox, for the third time this month.
His mother began to fill the brown bag, fruit and juice pack on the bottom, sandwich floating on top. She glanced at Peter, who wasn't eating his breakfast, but vivisecting his paper napkin with a knife. He had, so far, made the letters H and T.
If you procrastinate, you're going to miss the bus.
You've got to start being responsible, his father said.
When his father spoke, Peter pictured the words like smoke. They clouded up the room for a moment, but before you knew it, they'd be gone. For God's sake, Lewis, he's five.
I don't remember Joey losing his lunchbox three times during the first month of school. Peter sometimes watched his father playing soccer in the backyard with Joey. Their legs pumped like crazy pistons and gears, forward, backward, forward, as if they were doing a dance together with the ball caught between them. When Peter tried to join them, he got tangled up in his own frustration. The last time, he had scored against himself by accident. He looked over his shoulder at his parents.
I'm not Joey, he said,
and even though nobody answered, he could hear the reply.
We know.
Attorney Cormier? Alex glanced up to find a former client standing in front of her desk, beaming from ear to ear. It took her a moment to place him. Teddy McDougal, or McDonald, something like that. She remembered the charge, simple assault, domestic violence. He and his wife had gotten drunk and gone after each other. Alex had gotten him acquitted.
I got something for you, Teddy said.
I hope you didn't buy me anything, she answered, and she meant it.
This was a man from the North Country who was so poor that the floor of his house was literally dirt, and he stocked his freezer with the spoils of his own hunting. Alex was not a fan of hunting, but she understood that for some of her clients, like Teddy, it was not about sport, but survival. Which was exactly why a conviction for him would have been so devastating. It would have cost him his firearms.
I didn't buy it. Promise. Teddy grinned. It's in my truck. Come on out.
Can't you bring it in here?
Oh, no. No, can't do that.
Oh, excellent, Alex thought. What could he possibly have in his trunk that he can't bring in? She followed Teddy out to the parking lot, and in the back of his pickup truck saw a huge, dead bear.
This is for your freezer, he said.
Teddy, this is enormous. You could eat it all winter.
Damn right, but I thought of you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. But I don't, eat meat, and I wouldn't want it to go to waste.
She touched his arm.
I really want you to have it.
Teddy squinted into the sun.
All right.
He nodded at Alex, climbed into the cab of his truck, and bounced out of the parking lot as the bear thumped against the walls of the pickup bed.
Alex!
She turned to find her secretary standing in the doorway.
A call from your daughter's school just came in, the secretary said. Josie got sent to the principal's office.
Josie? In trouble at school?
For what?
Alex asked.
She beat the crap out of a boy on the playground.
Alex started toward her car.
Tell them I'm on my way.
On the ride home, Alex stole glances at her daughter in the rearview mirror. Josie had gone to school this morning in a white cardigan and khaki pants. Now that cardigan was streaked with dirt. There were twigs in her hair, which had fallen from its ponytail. The elbow of her sweater had a hole in it. Her lip was still bleeding. And, here was the amazing thing, apparently she'd fared better than the little boy she'd gone after.
Come on,
Alex said, leading Josie upstairs to the bathroom. There, she peeled off her daughter's shirt, washed her cuts, and covered them with Neosporin and Band-Aids. She sat down in front of Josie, on the bath mat that looked like it was made of Cookie Monster skin.
You want to talk about it?
Josie's lower lip quivered, and she started to cry.
It's Peter, she said. Drew picks on him all the time, and Peter gets hurt, so today I wanted it to be the other way around. Aren't there teachers on the playground?
Aides.
Well, you should have told them that Peter was getting teased. Beating up Drew only makes you just as bad as him in the first place.
We went to the aides, Josie complained. They told Drew and the other kids to leave Peter alone, but they never listen.
So, Alex said, you did what you thought was the best thing at the time?
Yeah, for Peter.
Imagine if you always did that. Let's say you decided that you liked someone else's coat better than yours, so you took it.
That would be stealing, Josie said.
Exactly. That's why there are rules. You can't break the rules. Not even when it seems like everyone else is doing it. Because if you do, if we all do, then the whole world becomes a very scary place. One where coats get stolen and people get beat up on the playground. Instead of doing the best thing, we sometimes have to settle for the rightest thing.
What's the difference?
The best thing is what you think should be done. The rightest thing is what needs to be done. When you think not just of you and how you feel, but also the extra stuff, who else is involved, and what's happened before, and what the rules say.
She glanced at Josie.
Why didn't Peter fight?
He thought he'd get in trouble.
I rest my case, Alex said.
Josie's eyelashes were spiked with tears.
Are you mad at me?
Alex hesitated. I'm angry at the aides for not paying attention when Peter was getting teased. And I'm not thrilled that you punched a boy in the nose. But I'm proud of you for wanting to defend your friend. She kissed Josie on the forehead. Go get some clothes that don't have holes in them, Wonder Woman. When Josie scrambled off into her bedroom, Alex remained sitting on the bathroom floor. It struck her that dispensing justice was really more about being present and engaged than anything else, unlike those aides on the playground, for example. You could be firm without being bossy, You could make it a point to know the rules. You could take all evidence into consideration before coming to a conclusion. Being a good judge, Alex realized, was not all that different from being a good mother. She stood up, went downstairs, and picked up the phone. Whit answered on the third ring.
Okay, she said. Tell me what I have to do.
The chair was too small beneath Lacey's bottom. Her knees didn't fit under the desk. The colors on the walls were too bright. The teacher who sat across from her was so young that Lacey wondered if she could go home and drink a glass of wine without breaking any laws.
Mrs. Houghton, the teacher said, I wish I could give you a better explanation, but the fact is, some kids are simply magnets for teasing. Other children see a weakness and they exploit it.
What's Peter's weakness? She said. The teacher smiled.
I don't see it as a weakness. He's sensitive, and he's sweet. But that means he's far less likely to be running around with the other boys playing police chase than he is to be coloring in a corner with Josie. The other children in the class notice.
Lacey remembered being in elementary school, not that much older than Peter, and raising chicks from an incubator. The six eggs had hatched, but one of the chicks was born with a gnarled leg. It was always the last to the feed tray and the water trough, and it was scrawnier and more tentative than its siblings. One day, while the class watched in horror, the maimed chick was pecked to death by the others. "The behavior of these other boys is not being tolerated," the teacher assured Lacey. "When we see it, we immediately send the child to the principal." She opened her mouth as if she was about to say something, and then snapped it shut.
"What?"
The teacher looked down at the desk.
"It's just that, unfortunately, that response can have the opposite effect. The boys identify Peter as the reason they're in trouble, and that perpetuates the cycle of violence."
Lacey felt her face growing hot. "What are you doing personally to make sure this doesn't happen again?" She expected the teacher to talk about a timeout chair or some retributive punishment that would be handed out if Peter was again taunted by the in-crowd. But instead, the young woman said,
"I'm showing Peter how to stand up for himself. If someone cuts him in the lunch line, or if he's teased, to say something in return, instead of just accepting it."
Lacey blinked at her.
I can't believe I'm hearing this. So if he gets shoved, he's supposed to shove back? When his food gets knocked on the floor, he should reciprocate?
Of course not. You're telling me that for Peter to feel safe in school, he's going to have to start acting like the boys who do this to him?
No. I'm telling you about the reality of grade school, the teacher corrected. Look, Mrs. Houghton, I can tell you what you want to hear. I can say that Peter is a wonderful child, which he is. I can tell you that school will teach tolerance and will discipline the boys who've been making Peter's life so miserable, and that this will be enough to stop it. But the sad fact is that if Peter wants it to end, he's going to have to be part of the solution.
Lacey looked down at her hands. They looked gargantuan on the surface of the tiny pupil's desk.
Thank you for your honesty.
She stood up carefully, because that is how it's best to move in a world where you no longer fit. She led herself out of the kindergarten classroom. Peter was waiting on a small wooden bench beneath the cubbies in the hall. It was her job as Peter's mother to smooth the road in front of him so that he wouldn't falter. But what if she couldn't bulldoze on his behalf all the time? Is that what the teacher had been trying to tell her? She squatted down in front of Peter and reached for his hands.
"You know I love you, right?" Lacey said.
Peter nodded.
"You know I only want what's best for you."
"Yes," Peter said.
"I know about the lunch boxes. I know what's been going on with Drew.
I heard about Josie punching him. I know the kinds of things he says to you."
Lacey felt her eyes fill with tears.
"The next time it happens, you have to stick up for yourself. You have to, Peter, or I'm going to have to punish you."
Life wasn't fair. Lacey had been passed over for promotions no matter how hard she had worked. She'd seen mothers who'd taken meticulous care of themselves deliver stillborns, while crack addicts had healthy infants. She'd seen 14-year-olds dying of ovarian cancer before they ever got a chance to really live. You couldn't fight the injustice of fate. You could only suffer it and hope that one day it might be different. But somehow, it was even more difficult to stomach on behalf of your child. It tore Lacey apart to have to be the one to pull back that curtain of innocence so that Peter would see that no matter how much she loved him, no matter how much she had wanted this world to be perfect for him, it would always fall short. Swallowing, she stared at Peter, trying to think of what she could do to spur him to self-defense, which punishment would make him change his behavior, even as it broke her heart to make him do just that. "If this happens again, no playdates with Josie for a month." She closed her eyes at the ultimatum. It was not the way she liked to parent, but apparently her usual advice, be kind, be polite, be what you want others to be, had done Peter no good. If a threat might make Peter roar, so loud that Drew and all those other awful children slunk away with their tails between their legs, then Lacey would do it. She brushed Peter's hair back from his face, watching the play of doubt cloud his features. And why shouldn't it? His mother had certainly never given him a directive like this before. "He's a bully, a jerk in a tiny package, but he'll grow up to be a bigger jerk. And you? You're going to grow up to be someone incredible." Lacey smiled widely at her son. "One day, Peter, everyone's going to know your name." There were two swings out on the playground, and sometimes you had to wait your turn for them. When that happened, Peter would cross his fingers and hope that he got the one that hadn't been swung around the top bar by a fifth grader, making it so that the seat was incredibly high off the ground and hard to get into. He was afraid he would fall off, trying to get on the swing, or, even more embarrassing, not even be able to hike himself up in the first place. When he waited with Josie, she always took that swing. She pretended she liked it, but Peter realized she was only pretending she didn't know how much he disliked it. Today at recess, they weren't swinging. Instead, they had twisted the chains round and round until they were as knotted as a throat, and then they'd lift up their feet and go spinning. Peter would sometimes look back at the sky and imagine that he was flying. When they stopped, his swing and Josie's staggered against each other, and their feet got all tangled. She laughed and lightly locked their ankles together so that they were connected, a human chain link. He turned to her. "I want people to like me," he blurted out. Josie tilted her head. "People do like you." Peter split his feet, disengaging them. "I meant people," he said, "who aren't you." The application to become a judge took Alex 2 full days to complete, and as she filled it out, a remarkable thing happened. She realized that she did actually want to be a judge. In spite of what she'd said to Whit, in spite of her earlier reservations, she was making the right decision for the right reasons. When the Judicial Selection Commission called for an interview, they made it clear that such invitations weren't extended to just anybody. That if Alex was being interviewed, she was being seriously considered for the position. The job of the commission was to give the governor a short list of candidates. Judicial Commission interviews were conducted at the old governor's mansion,
Bridges' house in East Concord. They were staggered, and candidates entered through one entrance and left through another, presumably so that no one knew who else was up for the job. The 12 members of the commission were lawyers, policemen, executive directors of victims' advocacy organizations. They stared so hard at Alex that she expected her face to burst into flames. It didn't help, either, that she had been up half the night with Josie, who'd awakened from a nightmare about a boa constrictor and refused to go back to sleep. Alex didn't know who the other candidates were for this position, but she'd wager that they weren't single moms who'd had to poke the radiator vents with a yardstick at 3 a.m. to prove that there weren't any snakes hiding in the dark tunnels.
"I like the pace," she said carefully, replying to a question.
There were answers she was expected to give, she knew. The trick was to somehow imbue the stock phrases and anticipated responses with part of her personality.
"I like the pressure of making a quick decision. I'm strong on the rules of evidence. I've been in courtrooms with justices who don't do their homework in advance, and I know I won't function that way."
She hesitated, looking around at the men and women, wondering if she should cultivate a persona like most of the other people who applied for judicial positions, and who had come through the hallowed ranks of the prosecutorial office, or if she should be herself and allow the petticoat hem of her public defender background to peek out.
Oh, hell. "I guess the reason I really want to be a judge is because I love the way a courtroom is an equal opportunity environment. When you come into it, for that brief amount of time, your case is the most important thing in the world to everyone in that room. The system works for you. It doesn't matter who you are or where you're from. Your treatment will depend on the letter of the law, not on any socioeconomic variables."
One of the commission members looked down at her notes.
"What do you think makes a good judge, Ms. Cormier?"
Alex felt a bead of sweat run down between her shoulder blades.
"Being patient but firm, being in control but not being arrogant, knowing the rules of evidence and the rules of a courtroom."
She paused.
"This is probably not what you're used to hearing, but I think a good judge probably is a whiz at tantrums."
An older woman from a victim's advocacy group blinked.
"I beg your pardon?" "Tantrums. I'm a mom. My little girl, she's 5. And there's this game she has where you're given a geometric outline of a figure, a boat, a train, a bird, and you somehow construct it from a set of puzzle pieces, triangles and parallelograms, some bigger than others. It's easy for a person with good spatial relations skills, because you really have to think outside the box. And being a judge is like that. You've got all these competing factors, the parties involved, the victims, law enforcement, society, even precedent, and you somehow have to use them to solve the problem within a given framework.
In the uncomfortable silence that followed, Alex turned her head and caught a glimpse through a window of the next interviewee arriving through the entrance vestibule. She blinked, certain she'd seen wrong, but you didn't forget the silvered curls that you'd once run your fingers through. You didn't put out of your mind the geography of cheekbones and jaw you'd traced with your own lips. Logan Rourke, her trial advocacy professor, her old lover, her daughter's father, headed into the building and closed the door. Apparently, he was a judicial candidate as well. Alex drew in her breath, even more determined to win this position than she had been a moment ago. "Ms. Cormier?" the older woman said again, and Alex realized she'd missed her question the first time around.
"Yes, sorry?"
"I asked how successful you are when you play tantrums."
Alex met her gaze.
"Ma'am," she said, letting a broad smile escape. "I'm the New Hampshire state champion."
At first, the numbers just looked fatter, But then they started to twist a little, and Peter had to either squinch up his face or get closer to see if it was a 3 or an 8. His teacher sent him to the nurse, who smelled like tea bags and feet, and she made him look at a chart on the wall. His new eyeglasses were light as a feather and had special lenses that wouldn't scratch even if he fell down and they went flying across a sandbox. The frames were made out of wire, too thin, in his opinion, to hold up the curved pieces of glass that made his eyes look like an owl's, oversized, bright, so blue. When Peter got his glasses, he was amazed. Suddenly, the blur in the distance coagulated into a farm with silos and fields and spots of cows. The letters on the red sign said, "Stop." There were tiny lines, like the creases on his knuckles, at the corners of his mother's eyes. All superheroes had accessories, Batman's belt, Superman's cape. This was his, and it gave him X-ray vision. He was so excited about having his new glasses that he slept with them. It wasn't until he got to school the next day that he understood that with better vision came perfect hearing. 4 eyes, blind as a bat. His glasses were no longer a mark of distinction, but only a scar, something else that made him different from everyone else. And that wasn't even the worst of it. As the world came into focus, Peter realized how people looked when they glanced at him, as if he were the punchline to a joke. And Peter, with his 20/20 vision, cast his eyes downward so that he wouldn't see. "We are subversive parents," Alex whispered to Lacey as they sat with their knees bent high as a grasshopper's at one of the undersized tables during open school day. She took the Cuisenaire rods used for math, bright colored unit strips of 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, and fashioned them to spell a curse word. "It's all fun and games until someone turns out to be a judge," Lacey chided, and she scattered the word with her hand. "Afraid I'm going to get you kicked out of kindergarten?" Alex laughed. "And as for the judge thing, that's about as much of a long shot as me winning the lottery." "We'll see," Lacey said. The teacher leaned down between them and handed each woman a small piece of paper. "Today I'm inviting all the parents to write down one word that best describes their child. Later, we'll make a love collage out of them." Alex glanced at Lacey. "A love collage?" "Stop being anti-kindergarten." "I'm not. In fact, I think everything you need to know about the law you learn in kindergarten. You know, don't hit, don't take what's not yours, don't kill people, don't rape them."
"Oh, yeah, I remember that lesson, right after snack time," Lacey said.
"You know what I mean. It's a social contract."
"What if you wound up on the bench and had to uphold a law you didn't believe in?"
"First off, that's a big if. And second, I'd do it. I'd feel horrible about it, but I'd do it," Alex said. "You don't want to judge with a personal agenda, believe me."
Lacey tore the edge of her paper into a fringe.
"If you become the job, then when do you get to be you?"
Alex grinned and pushed the Cuisenaire rods into another 4-letter word.
"At kindergarten open houses, I guess."
Suddenly, Josie appeared, rosy-cheeked and flushed.
"Mommy," she said, tugging on Alex's hand as Peter climbed onto Lacey's lap. "We're all done."
They had been in the block corner, creating a surprise. Lacey and Alex stood up, letting themselves be led past the book rack and the stacks of tiny carpets and the science table with its rotting pumpkin experiment, whose pitted skin and sunken flesh reminded Alex of the face of a prosecutor she knew.
"This is our house," Josie announced, pushing open a block that served as the front door. "We're married."
Lacey nudged Alex.
I always wanted to get along with my in-laws.
Peter stood at a wooden stove, mixing imaginary food in a plastic pot. Josie put on an oversized lab coat.
Time to go to work. I'll be home for dinner.
Okay, Peter said. We're having meatballs.
What's your job? Alex asked Josie.
I'm a judge. I send people to jail all day long, and then I come home and eat pescetti.
She walked around the perimeter of the blockhouse and re-entered through the front door.
Sit down, Peter said. You're late again.
Lacey closed her eyes.
Is it just me, or is this like looking into a really unflattering mirror?
They watched Josie and Peter put aside their plates and then move to another part of their block house, a smaller square within the square. They lay down inside it.
This is the bed, Josie explained.
The teacher came up behind Alex and Lacey.
They play house all the time, she said. Isn't it sweet?
Alex watched Peter curl up on his side. Josie spooned against him, wrapping her arm around his waist. She wondered how her daughter had ever formed an image of a couple like this in her mind, given that she'd never even seen her mother go out on a date. She watched Lacey lean against the block cubby and write, on her small slip of paper, tender. That did describe Peter. He was tender, almost to the point of being raw. It took someone like Josie, curled around him like a shell, to protect him. Alex reached for a pencil and smoothed out the piece of paper. Adjectives tumbled through her mind. There were so many for her daughter. Dynamic, loyal, bright, breathtaking. But she found herself forming different letters. Mine, she wrote. This time when the lunchbox hit the pavement, it broke wide across its hinges, and the car behind the school bus ran right over his tuna fish sandwich and his bag of Doritos. The bus driver, as usual, didn't notice. The fifth grade boys were so good at doing this by now that the window was opened and closed before you could even yell for them to stop. Peter felt his eyes welling with tears as the boys high-fived each other. He could hear his mother's voice in his head. This was the moment where he was supposed to stick up for himself. But his mother didn't realize that would only make it worse.
Oh, Peter,
Josie sighed as he sat down again beside her. He stared down at his mittens.
I don't think I can go to your house on Friday.
How come?
Because my mom said she'll punish me if I lose my lunchbox again.
That's not fair, Josie said.
Peter shrugged.
Nothing is.
No one was more surprised than Alex when the governor of New Hampshire officially picked her from a shortlist of three candidates for a district court judicial position. Although it made sense that Jean Shaheen, a young Democratic female governor, would want to appoint a young Democratic female judge, Alex was still a little lightheaded over the news when she went for her interview. The governor was younger than Alex had expected, and prettier.
Which is exactly what most people will think about me if I'm on the bench, she thought.
She sat down and slipped her hands under her thighs to keep them from shaking. If I nominate you, the governor said, is there anything I should know?
You mean skeletons in my closet?
Shaheen nodded. What it really came down to, for a gubernatorial appointee, was whether or not that nominee would in some way reflect poorly on the governor herself. Shaheen was trying to cross her T's and dot her I's before making any official decision, and for that, Alex could only admire her.
Is anyone going to come to your executive council hearing and oppose your nomination? The governor asked.
That depends. Are you giving out furloughs at the state prison?
Shaheen laughed.
I take it that's where your disgruntled clients have ended up.
That's exactly why they're disgruntled.
The governor stood up and shook Alex's hand.
I think we'll get along well, she said.
Maine and New Hampshire were the only two states left in the country with an executive council, a group that acted as a direct check on the governor's power. For Alex, this meant that in the month between her nomination and her confirmation hearing, she had to do whatever she could to placate five Republican men before they put her through the ringer. She called them weekly, asking if they had any questions they needed answered. She also had to arrange for witnesses to appear on her behalf at the confirmation hearing. After years in the public defender's office, this should have been simple, but the executive council didn't want to hear from lawyers. They wanted to hear from the community where Alex worked and lived, from her first-grade teacher to a state trooper who liked her in spite of her allegiance to the dark side. The tricky part was that Alex had to call in all her favors to get these people to prepare and testify, but she also had to make it clear that if she did get confirmed as a judge, she could give them nothing in return. And then, finally, it was Alex's turn to take the hot seat. She sat in the executive council office in the state house, fielding questions that ranged from, "What was the last book you read?" to, "Who has the burden of proof in abuse and neglect cases?" Most of the questions were substantive and academic, until she was thrown a curve. "Miss Cormier, who has the right to judge someone else?"
"Well," she said, "that depends on whether you're judging in a moral sense or a legal sense. Morally, no one has the right to judge anyone else, but legally, it's not a right, it's a responsibility."
"Following up on that, what is your position on firearms?"
Alex hesitated. She wasn't a fan of guns. She didn't let Josie watch anything on television that showed violence. She knew what happened when you put a gun in the hand of a troubled kid, or an angry husband, or a battered wife. She had defended those clients too many times to dismiss that kind of catalytic reaction. And yet, she was in New Hampshire, a conservative state, in front of a group of Republicans who were terrified she would turn out to be a left-wing loose cannon. She would be presiding over communities where hunting wasn't only revered, but necessary. Alex took a sip of water.
"Legally," she said, "I'm pro-firearms."
"It's crazy," Alex said as she stood in Lacey's kitchen. "You go to these robe sites online, and the models are all linebackers with breasts. The public perception of a female judge is one that looks like Bea Arthur." She leaned into the hallway and yelled up the stairs, "Josie, I'm counting to 10 and then we're leaving."
"Are there choices?"
"Yeah, black or black." Alex folded her arms. "You can get cotton and polyester, or just polyester. You can get bell sleeves or gathered sleeves. They're all hideous. What I really want is something with a waist."
"Guess Vera Wang doesn't do judicial," Lacey said.
"Not quite." She stuck her head into the hallway again.
"Josie, now!"
Lacey put down the dish towel she had been using to dry a pan and followed Alex into the hall.
"Peter, Josie's mother has to get home."
When there was no response from the children, Lacey headed upstairs. "They're probably hiding." Alex followed her into Peter's bedroom, where Lacey threw open the closet doors and checked beneath the bed. From there, they checked the bathroom, Joey's room, and the master bedroom. It wasn't until they went downstairs again that they heard voices coming from the basement.
"It's heavy,"
Josie said.
Then Peter,
"Here, like this."
Alex wound down the wooden stairway. Lacey's basement was a 100-year-old root cellar with a dirt floor and cobwebs strung like Christmas decorations. She homed in on the whispers coming from a corner of the basement, and there, behind a stack of boxes and a shelf full of home canned jelly, was Josie, holding a rifle.
"Oh, my God!"
Alex breathed, and Josie swung around, pointing the barrel at her. Lacey grabbed the gun and pulled it away. "Where did you get this?" she demanded, and only then did Peter and Josie seem to realize that something was wrong.
"Peter," Josie said, "he had a key."
"A key?" Alex cried.
"To what?"
"The safe," Lacey murmured. "He must have seen Lewis taking out a rifle when he went hunting last weekend."
"My daughter has been coming over to your house for how long now, and you've got guns lying around?"
"They're not lying around," Lacey said. "They're in a locked gun safe."
"Which your 5-year-old can open."
"Lewis keeps the bullets."
"Where?"
Alex demanded.
"Or should I just ask Peter?"
Lacey turned to Peter. "You know better. What on earth made you do this?"
"I just wanted to show it to her, Mom. She asked."
Josie lifted a frightened face.
"I did not."
Alex turned.
"So now your son's blaming Josie."
"Or your daughter's lying," Lacey countered. They stared at each other, two friends who had separated along the fault lines of their children. Alex's face was flushed.
"What if," she kept thinking. "What if they'd been 5 minutes later? What if Josie had been hurt, killed?"
On the edges of this thought, another one ignited. The answers she'd given the executive council weeks before. Who has the right to judge someone else?
"No one," she had said.
And yet, here she was, doing it.
"I'm pro-firearms," she had told them.
Did that make her a hypocrite? Or was she only being a good mother? Alex watched Lacey kneel beside her son, and that was all it took to trip the switch. Josie's steadfast loyalty to Peter suddenly seemed to only be a weight dragging her down. Maybe it was best for Josie if she started making other friends, friends who didn't get her called to the principal's office and who placed rifles in her hand. Alex anchored Josie to her side.
"I think we ought to leave."
"Yes," Lacey agreed, her voice cool. "I think that would be best." They were in the frozen food aisle when Josie began her tantrum.
"I don't like peas,"
she whined.
"You don't have to eat them."
Alex opened up the freezer door, letting the cold air kiss her cheek as she reached for the green giant vegetables.
"I want Oreos."
"You're not getting Oreos. You already had animal crackers." Josie had been contentious for a week now, ever since the fiasco at Lacey's house. Alex knew she couldn't keep Josie from being with Peter at school during the day, but that didn't mean she had to cultivate the relationship by allowing Josie to invite him over to play afterward. Alex hauled a vat of Poland Spring water into her cart, then a bottle of wine. On second thought, she reached for another.
"Do you want chicken or hamburger for dinner?" "I want tofurkey."
Alex started laughing.
"Where did you hear about tofurkey?" "Lacey made it for us for lunch. They're like hot dogs, but they're better for you."
Alex stepped forward as her number was called at the meat counter.
"Can I have a 1/2 pound of boneless chicken breasts?" "How come you get what you want, but I never get what I want?"
Josie accused.
"Believe me, you're not as deprived a child as you'd like to think you are." "I want an apple," Josie announced.
Alex sighed.
"Can we just please get through the grocery store without you saying, 'I want,' again?"
Before Alex realized what her daughter was doing, Josie kicked out from the seat of the shopping cart, catching Alex hard in the middle.
"I hate you," Josie screamed. "You're the worst mom in the whole world!"
Alex was uncomfortably aware of the other shoppers looking at her. The old woman feeling melons, the grocery employee with his fists full of fresh broccoli. Why did kids always fall apart in venues where you would be duly measured for your actions?
Josie, she said, smiling through her teeth. Calm down.
I wish you were like Peter's mother. I wish I could just go live with them.
Alex grasped her shoulders, hard enough to make Josie burst into tears.
You listen to me, she said in a heated undertone, and then she caught a distant whisper and the word judge.
There had been an article in the local paper about her recent appointment to the district court. It ran with a photo. Alex had felt the spark of recognition when she passed people in the baking aisle and the cereal aisle. Oh, that's her. But right now, she also felt the checks and balances of their stares as they watched her with Josie, waiting for her to act, well, judiciously. She relaxed her grasp.
I know you're tired,
Alex said, loud enough for the rest of the entire store to hear.
I know you want to go home, but you have to behave when we're out in public.
Josie blinked through her tears, listening to the voice of reason and wondering what this alien creature had done with her real mother, who would have yelled right back at her and told her to cut it out. A judge, Alex suddenly realized, doesn't get to be a judge only on the bench. She's still a judge when she goes out to a restaurant or dances at a party or wants to throttle her child in the middle of the produce aisle. Alex had been given a mantle to wear without realizing that there was a catch. She would never be allowed to take it off. If you spent your life concentrating on what everyone else thought of you, would you forget who you really were? What if the face you showed the world turned out to be a mask, with nothing beneath it? Alex pushed the cart toward the checkout lines. By now, her raging child had turned into a contrite little girl again. She listened to Josie's diminishing hiccups.
There, she said, to comfort herself as much as her daughter. Isn't that better?
Alex's first day on the bench was spent in Keene. No one but her clerk would know officially that it was her first day. Attorneys had heard she was new, but weren't sure when she quite started. And yet, she was terrified. She changed her outfit 3 times, even though no one would see it underneath her robe. She threw up 2x before she left for the courthouse. She knew how to get to chambers. After all, she had tried cases here on the other side of the bench 100 times. The clerk was a thin man named Ishmael, who remembered Alex from their previous meetings and hadn't particularly liked her. She'd cracked up after he introduced himself.
Call me Ishmael.
Today, however, he practically fell at her high-heeled feet.
Welcome, Your Honor, he said. Here's your docket. I'll take you to your chambers, and we'll send a court officer in to get you when you're ready. Is there anything else I can do for you?
No, Alex said. I'm all set.
He left her in chambers, which were freezing cold. She adjusted the thermostat and pulled her robe out of her briefcase to dress. There was an adjoining bathroom. Alex stepped inside to scrutinize herself. She looked fair, commanding, and maybe a little like a choir girl. She sat down at the desk and immediately thought of her father.
Look at me, Daddy, she thought,
although by now he was in a place where he couldn't hear her. She could remember dozens of cases he had tried. He'd come home and tell her about them over dinner. What she couldn't remember were the moments when he wasn't a judge and was just her father. Alex scanned the files she needed for that morning's run of arraignments. Then she looked at her watch. She still had 45 minutes before court went into session. It was her own damn fault for being so nervous that she'd gotten here too early. She stood up, stretched. She could do cartwheels in this room. It was that big. But she wouldn't,
because judges didn't do that. Tentatively, she opened the door to the hall, and immediately Ishmael materialized.
Your Honor, what can I do for you?
Coffee, Alex said. That would be nice.
Ishmael jumped on this request so fast that Alex realized if she asked him to go out and buy a gift for Josie's birthday, he would have it wrapped and on her desk by noon. She followed him into the lounge, one shared by attorneys and other judges, and walked toward the coffee maker. Immediately, a young attorney fell back.
"You go right ahead, Your Honor," she said, giving up her place in line.
Alex reached for a paper cup. She'd have to remember to bring a mug to leave in chambers. Then again, since her position was a rotating one that would take her through Laconia, Concord, Keene, Nashua, Rochester, Milford, Jaffrey, Peterborough, Grafton, and Coos, depending on what day of the week it was, she'd have to find a lot of coffee mugs. She pushed down on the thermal coffee dispenser, only to have it whistle and hiss. Empty. Without even thinking about it, she reached for a filter to make a fresh pot.
"Your Honor, you don't have to do that," the attorney said,
clearly embarrassed on Alex's behalf. She took the filter out of her hand and started to make the coffee. Alex stared at the lawyer. She wondered if anyone would ever call her Alex again, or if she should just have her name officially changed to Your Honor. She wondered if anyone would have the guts to tell her if she had toilet paper hanging off her shoe as she walked down the hall, or if she had spinach in her teeth. It was a strange feeling to be scrutinized so carefully, and to know all the same that no one would ever dare to tell her to her face that something was wrong. The lawyer brought her the maiden cup of fresh coffee.
"I wasn't sure how you liked it, Your Honor," she said, offering sugar and creamer cups.
"This is fine," Alex said,
but as she reached for the cup, her bell sleeve caught the edge of the styrofoam and the coffee spilled.
"Smooth, Alex," she thought.
"Oh, gosh," the lawyer said. "I'm sorry."
"Why are you sorry?" Alex wondered, "when it was my fault."
The girl was already setting out napkins to clean up the mess, so Alex stripped off her gown to clean it. For one giddy moment, she thought about not stopping there, disrobing completely, down to her bra and panties, and parading through the courthouse like the emperor in the fairy tale.
"Isn't my gown beautiful?" she'd say, and she would listen to everyone answer, "Oh, yes, Your Honor."
She rinsed the sleeve off in the sink and wrung it dry. Then, still carrying her robe, she started back to chambers. But the thought of sitting there for another half hour, alone, was too depressing, so instead, Alex began to wander the halls of the Keene courthouse. She took turns she'd never taken before, and wound up at a basement door that led to a loading zone. Outside, she found a woman dressed in the green jumpsuit of a groundskeeper, smoking a cigarette. The air was full of winter, and frost glittered on the asphalt like broken glass. Alex wrapped her arms around herself. It was quite possibly even colder out here than in chambers, and nodded at the stranger.
"Hi," she said.
"Hey."
The woman exhaled a stream of smoke.
"I haven't seen you around here before.
What's your name?"
"Alex." "I'm Liz. I'm the whole property maintenance department," she grinned. "So where do you work in the courthouse?"
Alex fumbled in her pocket for a box of Tic Tacs, not that she wanted or needed a mint, but because she wanted to buy some time before this conversation came to a screeching halt.
She said. "I'm the judge."
Immediately, Liz's face fell, and she stepped back, uncomfortable.
"You know, I hate telling you that, because it was so nice the way you just struck up a conversation with me. No one else around here will do that, and it's... well, it's a little lonely."
Alex hesitated.
"Could you maybe forget that I'm the judge?"
Liz ground out the cigarette beneath her boot.
"Depends.
Alex nodded. She turned the small plastic box of mints over in her palm. They rattled like music.
You want a tic-tac?
After a moment, Liz held out her hand.